The night Duke Reed walked into a recording session at Treasure Isle with a loaded shotgun strapped across his back and a pistol holstered on each hip, nobody said a word, not the session musicians, not the engineers, not the vocalist trembling behind the microphone, who had arrived 20 minutes late. Duke Reed did not raise his voice. He did not make threats. He stood in the control room doorway, looked at the clock on the wall, looked at the tardy singer, looked back at the clock, and then sat down in his chair. The session ran without incident. The song they cut that afternoon became one of the defining records of 1966 Jamaican music. Nobody talked about the guns afterward. The guns were simply part of the room. That was Duke Reed's philosophy of power. Not what you did with it, but what you made people believe you were capable of. In the history of Jamaican popular music, the names that surface first are almost always the artists. Bob Marley, Peter Tosh, Toots, Dennis Brown. The voices, the faces, the philosophy. But beneath every immortal vocal line recorded in Kingston between 1959 and 1975 was an infrastructure of men who built the rooms, powered the speakers, pressed the acetates, and controlled the money. Duke Reed was the most formidable of them, a former policeman turned liquor merchant, turned sound system warrior, turned record producer, whose Treasure Isle label defined the Rocksteady era with an authority no other studio could match. He did not create Jamaican music. He did not discover its soul. What he did was more complicated, more contested, and ultimately more consequential. He gave that music its commercial architecture, its competitive ferocity, and its first genuine international ambitions. Osborne Ruddock, the man the world would eventually know as King Tubby, once said that working around Duke Reed taught him more about sound than anything else in his career. What Tubby learned was not music theory. It was the physics of intimidation. How a bass frequency, correctly deployed, makes a crowd surrender. How the space between notes is as important as the note itself. How a room falls silent before the right sound fills it. Duke Reed understood all of this before he could articulate it in any technical vocabulary. He understood it with his body, with his instincts, with the part of him that had once held authority over life and death in the streets of Kingston. He was born around 1915 in the Maxfield Avenue area of Western Kingston, a neighborhood that in the mid-20th century sat at the intersection of legitimate poverty and organized desperation. The precise date of his birth is uncertain across multiple sources, though the Jamaica Gleaner's 1975 obituaries and subsequent archival reporting consistently place his origins in the Maxfield corridor. His father was a small merchant. His mother ran a yard. Duke Reed grew up understanding the basic algebra of Kingston survival, that respect flowed from two sources, money and fear, and that the most durable form of either was the combination of both. He joined the Jamaica Constabulary Force in the 1940s. His years as a police officer are not well documented in the primary historical record, though multiple contemporaneous accounts place him in active duty in Kingston through the late 1940s. What those years did to him, or for him, can be read in everything that followed. He learned how crowds moved. He learned how information flowed through communities. He learned how to read a situation before it escalated, and how to escalate one precisely when it served his purposes. He was not known as a corrupt officer in the way that word is typically used. He was known as effective. These are, in Kingston's long history, not always the same thing. By the early 1950s, Reed and his wife Lucille had opened a liquor store on Bond Street in Kingston's commercial district. The store was called Treasure Isle Liquors, the name that would eventually travel around the world on the labels of some of the most important Jamaican recordings ever made. The liquor business was legitimate. It was also, in the way of all successful enterprises in mid-century Kingston, a social institution. The store became a gathering point. Conversations happened. Connections were made. Duke Reed learned who knew whom, who owed whom, and who was about to owe whom. He was building the same kind of information infrastructure in commerce that he had learned in law enforcement, The sound system arrived almost naturally from this position. In Kingston in the early 1950s, the sound system was not yet the cultural institution it would become. It was still finding its form. Outdoor parties, makeshift speaker rigs, imported American R&B records played at enormous volumes for dancing crowds in yards and open lots. But the men who controlled these systems were already understanding something fundamental, that the right music, played loud enough, in the right place, for the right crowd, was its own kind of authority. Tom Wong, better known as Tom the Great Sebastian, had already established himself as the pioneer of this form. By the time Duke Reed entered the field, Sebastian's system was already legendary, already the standard by which others were measured. Reed entered the competition with characteristic forcefulness. He called his system Duke Reed the Trojan, a name drawn from the Trojan Records imprint he would later build into one of the most important catalogs in Caribbean music history. The Trojan identity was not accidental. It suggested siege. It suggested entry by cunning and force. It suggested that what appeared to be a gift might also be a weapon. Duke Reed built his sound system with money from the liquor store, imported amplifiers that were larger than anything his rivals were using, and a personal presence at his dances that made every competitor acutely aware of what was at stake. The great rivalry of the Kingston sound system era was between Duke Reed and Clement Coxon Dodd. These two men defined the competitive architecture of Jamaican popular music from the mid-1950s through the early 1970s. Their rivalry was not merely commercial, it was philosophical, personal, and occasionally dangerous. Reed's sound, the Trojan, was raw power, enormous bass, physical impact, records that hit the body before they reached the mind. Dodd's system, the Downbeat, was more sophisticated in its curation, more careful in its selection. Both men traveled to the United States regularly in the late 1950s to find exclusive records that their rivals had not yet sourced. Both men had informants in record stores and radio stations. Both men employed people whose job was to ensure that the competition did not find out what was coming before it was too late to respond. Duke Reed's approach to this competition involved methods that were, by the most charitable interpretation, aggressive. There are multiple documented accounts reported in the Jamaica Gleaner and extensively examined in Lloyd Bradley's Bass Culture of Reed's associates disrupting rival dances, of sound equipment being sabotaged, of pressure being applied to venue owners who might otherwise have hosted Coxon's system. Reed himself was always several degrees removed from these incidents. The guns on his hips were never fired at a rival's speakers. The violence, where it existed, was plausible deniable. He was too smart, too calculated, to become legally compromised by his own methods. What he allowed to be associated with his name was sufficient. The rest was left to implication. But to reduce Duke Reed to his intimidation tactics is to miss the most important thing about him, which is that the intimidation was a shell around a genuine and profound musical intelligence. This is where the historical accounts struggle, because it is easier to dramatize the guns than to explain the ear. Duke Reed could hear, in a way that his peers often could not, what a record needed to be before it became what it was. He could hear the space in a rhythm that wanted to be filled. He could hear when a vocal was working against itself and when it was finding its true depth. His session musicians, the men who would later be collectively understood as among the best Jamaica ever produced, feared him and respected him in roughly equal measure, and the respect was earned not just by the pistols but by the fact that when Reed told a musician something wasn't working, what usually wasn't working, the transition from sound system operator to record producer happened simultaneously for Reed and Dodd in the late 1950s and early 1960s, as both men recognized the same fundamental truth, that controlling the records, rather than merely playing them, was the only sustainable form of dominance in this industry. When you played someone else's record, your power lasted as long as the exclusivity held. When you owned the record, your power was permanent. Duke Reed built Treasure Isle Studios, a facility at 33 Bond Street, above the liquor store that had started everything, and began recording Jamaican artists with a seriousness of purpose that quickly separated his operation from the competition. The ska era of the early 1960s saw Treasure Isle producing solidly, but Reed's greatest moment had not yet arrived. Ska, the upbeat, offbeat, horn-driven sound of the early independence period, suited Coxoney's downbeat sensibility better than Reed's. The Rocksteady era changed everything. Rocksteady emerged around 1966 and 1967, and its emergence is one of the most significant transitions in the history of popular music. The tempo slowed. The bass moved to the front of the mix. The horns receded. The voices became more prominent, more emotional, more directly confessional. Where ska had been a music of celebration, of a new nation asserting its energy into the world, rocksteady was a music of recognition. The reality of Jamaican independence, with its unresolved poverty, its garrison politics, its disappointed expectations, had begun to settle over Kingston. Rocksteady sounded like that recognition felt. Duke Reed heard it before anyone else in a position of power was willing to commit to it. While other producers hesitated, uncertain whether this new, slower sound would hold the crowd, whether the dancing public would accept music that demanded more stillness, more attention, more emotional presence, Reed moved. He moved with the same decisive authority that had characterized everything else he had ever done in his life. Treasure Isle became the premier rocksteady studio in Jamaica almost overnight. The roster of artists he assembled in 1966 and 1967 reads like a who's who of the genre's defining voices. Alton Ellis was the first and most important, a vocalist of extraordinary emotional range who had been working the Kingston music scene since the early ska period. Ellis found his full voice at Treasure Isle under Reed's direction. Rocksteady, the song that gave the entire genre its name, was recorded at Treasure Isle and produced by Duke Reed in 1966. The song did not merely name the genre, it defined its emotional center. Ellis's voice, over a bass line that seemed to breathe with its own intelligence, established the standard by which every subsequent rocksteady vocal would be measured. Reed heard in Ellis something that the other producers had not quite captured, a capacity for vulnerability that was not weakness, for tenderness that was not sentiment. He created the conditions in which that voice could operate at its maximum. Phyllis Dillon was another Treasure Isle cornerstone, a vocalist of refined delicacy, whose recordings for Reed occupy a specific and irreplaceable space in the Rocksteady catalog. The Techniques, a harmony group whose lineup included Pat Kelly and Bruce Ruffin, produced some of the most beautiful recordings ever made in Jamaica under Reed's direction. The Melodians, a trio who would later achieve international recognition through their contribution to the Harder They Come soundtrack, cut essential rocksteady sides at Treasure Isle. Toots and the Maytals, though primarily associated with other producers in their definitive period, also recorded with Reed and acknowledged his technical standards. Inside the recording sessions, Reed's working method was simultaneously terrifying and productive. He demanded absolute punctuality. He demanded absolute sobriety. He demanded that session musicians and Treasure Isle employed some of the most accomplished players in Jamaica, including members of the core rhythm section collective that would later be understood as foundational to the entire reggae transition, play with full concentration from the first take. He did not permit casual takes. He did not permit the kind of exploratory looseness that characterizes many of the most celebrated recording sessions in music history. What he permitted was preparation, precision, and execution. Some of the musicians who worked there resented it. Most of them, in retrospect, acknowledged that the discipline produced results that looser arrangements might not have achieved. The mystery of the vanished sessions has circulated through Jamaican music research for decades. Multiple sources, including session musicians who worked at Treasure Isle through the mid-1960s, have referenced a specific recording date in 1966 or early 1967 when Reed scrapped an entire session. The accounts vary in their details. Some say the session involved an artist Reed later fell out with, Some say it was a rhythm track that didn't satisfy him. Some say the acetate was deliberately broken. What is consistent across multiple independent accounts is that a session happened, that the recordings were not released, and that the masters have never surfaced in any known collection. Whether Reed destroyed them in a moment of perfectionist rage, whether they are buried in some uncatalogued portion of the Treasure Isle vault, or whether the accounts have been embellished through decades of retelling, is genuinely uncertain. The mystery thread, the acetate that was never heard, sits beneath the surface of the Treasure Isle story, like a bass note that never resolves. By the late 1960s, as Rocksteady began its evolution into early reggae, Duke Reed's relationship with the music was changing. He was not a young man. The speed of change in Jamaican music, its accelerating restlessness, its hunger for new rhythms and new production approaches, was moving faster than it had in the era that had made him. Treasure Isle continued to produce excellent work into the early 1970s, but the absolute dominance of the Rocksteady peak was not replicated in the reggae era. King Tubby, who had by this point established himself as a freelance engineer working with multiple producers, was doing transformative work in the dub idiom that was reconfiguring what Jamaican music was capable of. Lee Scratch Perry's Black Ark was producing sounds that seemed to come from another dimension. The landscape was shifting beneath everyone's feet. Duke Reed's relationship with Tubby during these years is one of the under-examined chapters of the Treasure Isle story. Tubby worked for Reed in an official capacity as an engineer at the studio, and the skills he developed there, his understanding of the mixing board as an instrument, his ability to hear frequencies that others missed, were directly shaped by the professional standards Reed demanded. When Tubby later revolutionized Jamaican music with his dub mixing techniques, he was applying an ear trained in part by Reed's uncompromising perfectionism. The teacher and the student moved in different directions, but the student's greatest innovations bore the teacher's fingerprints. Duke Reed died in 1975. The cause, according to the Jamaica Gleaner's coverage at the time and subsequent historical sources, was complications from surgery. He was approximately 60 years old. His death came at a moment when the international reggae explosion, powered primarily by Bob Marley, and the infrastructure Island Records had built around Jamaican music, was reaching its peak. The music that Reed had done so much to shape was becoming the most important popular music export the Caribbean had ever produced, and Duke Reed was gone, unable to participate in or profit from that transformation. His wife Lucille Reed assumed control of Treasure Isle after his death and demonstrated an administrative capability that had been apparently always there and largely unacknowledged. Under her stewardship, the catalog was maintained, the label continued to operate, and the legacy of what Duke Reed had built was preserved rather than allowed to dissipate. This was not a small thing. In Jamaican music history, the estates of great producers have often been mismanaged, disputed, or lost to legal and commercial confusion. The Treasure Isle catalog survived with relative integrity, in part because Lucille Reed understood what her husband had built and was determined to protect it. The legacy debate around Duke Reed is genuine and unresolved. On one side are those who see him primarily as a figure of coercion, a man whose authority over artists was exercised through fear as much as merit, who extracted maximum commercial value from musicians who were often underpaid and undercontracted, who operated in the tradition of exploitative record production that characterized the early decades of the Jamaican music industry, regardless of who was running the studio. On the other side are those who argue with substantial evidence that the discipline and sonic standards Reed imposed produced recordings that have survived longer and meant more than the work of producers whose sessions were managed more loosely and more generously. The tension between these positions is real, and it does not resolve into a clean verdict. What is not in dispute is the catalog itself. The Treasure Isle recordings from the Rocksteady era, Alton Ellis's best work, the Technique's harmonies, Phyllis Dillon's crystalline precision, the melodeons at their most emotionally exposed, represent a body of Jamaican music that has maintained its power across six decades. These recordings do not sound dated. They sound like they were made yesterday by people who understood something about human feeling that most popular music is content to approximate. That understanding was Duke Reed's contribution. Not the guns, not the reputation, not the sound system that made the crowd surrender to the bass. The understanding that great music is built, not stumbled into, and that the building requires an absolute standard that no one, not the artist, not the engineer, not the session musician running 5 minutes late, is exempt from meeting. The vanished acetate from that 1966 session has never been found. No collector, no archivist, no estate representative has surfaced a recording that matches the description that has circulated through the oral history of Treasure Isle for 50 years. Some researchers believe it never existed, that the story grew from a rumor, as these things do in the compressed and competitive world of Jamaican music, where information is currency and mythology is always available to fill the gaps left by poor documentation. Others believe it exists, somewhere in the Treasure Isle vault or in someone's private collection, waiting to be identified. If it does exist and is ever found, it will tell us something we do not currently know about what Duke Reed heard in that studio in the middle of the decade that produced the most concentrated body of Jamaican music recordings ever made. What we already know is enough to understand his significance. Duke Reed was the man who walked into rooms with guns on his hips and produced recordings that never sound like violence. That contradiction is the core of the Treasure Isle story. The man who enforced silence in his sessions made music that has never stopped speaking.